Look at almost any recent major news story from Russia, and you'll find the Federal Security Service, better known as the FSB. Having failed to prevent the Crocus City Hall terrorist attack in Moscow last month, the FSB has played a major role in arresting and, by all appearances, torturing the suspected perpetrators. It was FSB agents who arrested Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich on espionage charges just over a year ago. The agency has also, of course, been heavily involved in enforcing Russia's wartime crackdowns on dissent and LGBTQ+ rights. At the same time, the FSB is inextricably linked to Moscow's war against Ukraine. After years of carrying out subversive activities there, it provided Putin with key, though apparently misleading, intel that led him to launch his full-scale invasion in 2022. Since then, its agents have facilitated the abduction of Ukrainian children, tortured an untold number of Ukrainian civilians in so-called torture chambers, and tried to plant former ISIS members in Ukrainian battalions. And let's not forget that Putin himself was shaped by his career in the FSB's predecessor organization, the Soviet-era KGB. Putin's rise to power was defined by his image as a strong man who could ensure security and stability, and since assuming the presidency, he's given himself direct authority over the FSB and steadily expanded its ability to surveil and repress Russian citizens. But in the stream of news stories about the Kremlin's aggression in Ukraine and repressions in Russia, it's easy to see the FSB is just one more state agency doing the president's bidding. So when I learned that Kevin Reel, a former counterintelligence analyst for the US government and an expert in foreign intelligence services, had a new book out on the FSB's history, I was eager to interview him. Welcome to The Naked Pravda. Hi there, I'm Medusa in English senior news editor Sam Brazil, and you're listening to The Naked Pravda. For this week's show, I sat down with Dr. Kevin Reel, whose new book, The Russian FSB, A Concise History of the Federal Security Service, is out now from Georgetown University Press. We talked about the FSB's origins, its operations in Russia and abroad, its likely future after Putin, and much more. So without further ado, here's our conversation.
I'm Kevin Reel. I am currently a lecturer in intelligence and international security at Brunel University, London. I retired from the US government in 2021 and have been teaching in universities since then. I worked for about 30 years in the counterintelligence field in the US government, and that led me to interest in studying and delving into the activities of foreign intelligence services and security services. And my academic background is mostly in Russia and Russian intelligence. So those two things then conjoined and led to the publication of this book on the Russian Federal Security Service.
So without getting too much into the history yet, if possible, what is the FSB officially, and then maybe kind of more descriptively in 2024?
The FSB is Russia's primary internal security service. Its biggest mission is internal security. That means it's a mix of internal domestic intelligence, law enforcement, and basically regime support, regime security. Its main mission is to ensure that the Putin regime is not threatened. That includes threats from the inside, from oppositionists, from crime, from divisions within the country, but also threats from the outside, meaning foreign intelligence services, foreign dissident groups. And in the Russian mind, those two things are always connected. Any opposition inside Russia is always assumed to have a connection to an outside organization. And outside organizations are always assumed to be trying to destroy Russia, outside oppositionist organizations. So there is a direct link that Russia makes to both inside and outside. And the FSB is a primary operational entity for pursuing those links and pursuing the threats that are caused by those links. So it has a large law enforcement function, enforces a variety of laws, from counterterrorism laws to extremism laws, economic and financial laws, immigration and customs laws. There is a Russian Customs Service, but the FSB is also involved in the Russian Border Guard Service is part of the FSB, which means it is very much involved in the securing of the borders and the prevention of contraband from crossing into Russia. There is no direct equivalent to the FSB in any democratic or Western country. In the book, I mentioned kind of a rough equivalency of what the FSB would be if you translated it into a U.S. context. And that U.S. context includes the FBI, portions of the Department of Homeland Security, portions of the Department of Defense, portions of the Central Intelligence Agency, the National Security Agency, and includes even portions of the Environmental Protection Agency, the law enforcement portions, and the Securities and Exchange Commission, which also has a law enforcement function. All of those different functions fall under the FSB. So there's nothing like it in a Western country.
When I talk about the FSB in sort of informal contexts, I usually equate it with the Soviet KGB. If I'm talking to American friends or something, I'll say, oh, you know, the FSB, it's the KGB, it's the modern KGB. But of course, the FSB and the KGB are two distinct agencies in two distinct countries with different ideologies, or whatever Putin's Russia can be said to have. So what are the differences between the KGB's kind of ideological purpose and what defined it in terms of its mission, and the same things for the FSB?
The FSB is formed by a number of forces. One of those is the KGB, and you can't ignore that. The KGB does feed, essentially, or does create much of the structure for the FSB today. And there are senior leaders in the FSB today who grew up in the KGB. So they bring with them a lot of the mindsets that existed during the KGB. It is not simply a carbon copy, because there are changes in Russian society today that are reflected in the FSB. One of those changes is a renewed embracing of the pre-Bolshevik Tsarist era. During the Soviet era, it would be taboo to talk about the virtues of the Okhrana or the Tsarist political police. Those were bourgeois pre-Bolshevik organizations that the Bolshevik Revolution was intended to sweep away. So you weren't allowed to talk about those. There were occasions when the methods of the pre-Bolshevik state security services were taught in the KGB, but you weren't allowed to talk about it openly. Today, that pre-Bolshevik era is explicitly discussed. And there even are examples of people from the pre-Bolshevik era that are held up as emulations. There were political police that conducted internal investigations and internal security measures that are now discussed even in the FSB's own publications. They're very openly discussed. It's not just a under the table, well, let's look back at that period. It is openly discussed as a period of emulation. That's one big difference. And with that difference comes a renewal of a religious element, a socially conservative element that existed in the pre-Bolshevik era that also was taboo during the Soviet era. So the connection between the FSB and the Orthodox Church is also overt. There's in 2016, I believe it was, a chapel was built on the grounds of the FSB Academy, and that the patriarch of the Russian Orthodox Church personally came and dedicated that chapel. There, the discussion of social morals and the things that Putin discusses and others in the presidential administration discuss, that is a direct part of the FSB today. Again, something very different than the KGB era. Another thing that makes the FSB different from the KGB era is the 1990s. The 1990s were an era of chaos, weakness, of economic, political, and military crumbling of Russia. And that's a period of humiliation, embarrassment for Russians who lived through that period. And today, senior FSB leaders, particularly those who lived during the Soviet era before the 1990s, are very intent, and Putin himself has said this, on never allowing Russia to appear weak again. And the FSB is a direct element to renew that strength. There are other elements. There's military. There's within the military, there's a kind of a renewal of the moral ideological monitoring that existed during the Cold War era. But the FSB is a major force in that because it is represented throughout the entire country. And it has the law enforcement and intelligence responsibilities to seek any threats to that power of Russia.
If you picture sort of the counterfactual, if an FSB guy hadn't taken the presidency in 2000, how consequential would that be? Because it can sometimes just seem like Russia has reverted to its natural state of having a strong security service. So can you talk a little bit about Putin's role?
Well, Putin's role is extremely important. I mean, the fact that he did live the KGB himself is important. That combined with those other two elements, the renewal of the Tsarist era kind of symbols and the 1990s humiliation, all of those come together. But even before Putin became the director of the FSB in 1998, there was a lot of discussion about having to prevent the fragmentation of Russia, to prevent the weakening of Russia. Putin has been a major force in pushing that. But it actually began before he did. And as to your point, the basically reversion to the natural state of Russia, of where there's a strong state security service that is loyal to the ruling power, that is certainly an element of what the FSB is today. And that began even before Putin came along. What Putin brings, though, is a strong patron relationship with the FSB, and a close personal relationship with the FSB leaders. Bortnikov is a good friend of Putin from the St. Petersburg days. He has the ear of Putin. He's in the inner circle, and that gives the FSB both power and direct tasking from the president. And because the president Putin is so comfortable in that environment, he is very comfortable using that tool.
You talk in your book about how the KGB was viewed as a really, or maybe a generally non-corrupt institution. At least in the late Soviet Union, when people were more aware of mass repressions and murders carried out by the NKVD, the KGB's predecessor under Stalin, it can seem a little bit odd that an agency so associated with fear can have this reputation for honesty.
Those two things actually go directly together. There's a difference between corruption and repression. Corruption means that the individuals are enriching themselves through their state security employment. Repression means that the state security service is preventing opposition to the ruling party. The reason the KGB was trusted with that role of basically securing the party is because it wasn't as involved in the corruption. Now, that's not to say that there was never such thing as corruption in the KGB. Of course, there was. But if you read the writings of KGB officers from the 1970s and 80s, they are pretty clear in saying that they saw corruption around them. The senior party leaders were deeply corrupt, but the KGB didn't have a lot of power to do anything about that because it was the party that really ran the country, not the KGB. And the KGB got its marching orders from the party, and it fulfilled those marching orders. And if the marching orders did not include prosecuting someone for corruption who had high-level patronage at the party level, then the KGB couldn't do much about it. They could just sit by and watch.
So to contrast that with the FSB, where did the corruption start and how corrupt is it really today?
The corruption began with the confusion, the loss of direction, the loss of cohesion that followed the dissolution of the Soviet Union. The 1990s, as I mentioned earlier, were a period of chaos. And it was not clear what was the coalescing purpose any longer. The party was that coalescing purpose during the Soviet era. Everyone was supposed to pull together to support the party. When the party was stripped away, that left the post-KGB officers, those that were in FSB eventually by 1995, but other organizations like the SVR, like the Federal Protective Service and other KGB heirs, left them with no reason to do their job except for their own benefit. Yeltsin was seen as a corrupt politician. He was, to a great extent. And when the FSB officers saw that, they said, they would kind of said to themselves, and there's a lot of FSB officers who've written about this, like, I don't think I can support that. Why am I tasked with securing this regime when it's such a corrupt organization? I'm just going to go support myself. And in the 1990s, were times when the officers didn't get paid regularly, and they went out and found their own work. And a lot of times that work was in corruption and their own investigative accesses, particularly that regulation of the economic system, the banking system, the industry, that gave them access to large amounts of money. As they regulated the banking industry, for example, and this is where a lot of that corruption has come from, they saw very explicitly who had the money. And they could use their investigative power to basically skim some of that off. And that's what they began to do, because it was just, they weren't getting paid anyway. And we didn't have a good reason to operate any longer. What are we actually loyal to anymore? And they became loyal to their own interests.
So then fast forward to today, I imagine a lot of them are still loyal to their own interests. But are there some true believers in Putinism? Are there people who dreamed of working for the FSB and are really proud to do it because they're serving a cause they believe in?
Certainly there are some, yes. There are definitely officers who are trying to do the right thing. Today, the right thing means supporting Putin's policies. In the Russian context, that's what that means. So yes, there are officers that are loyal to that. And there's probably a clash. And there are some defectors who have left the FSB in the past 2 years who have discussed somewhat of a clash within the FSB between those who are true believers and those who are disgusted by what they're seeing, but they continue to obey their orders because that's what you do. You obey the orders. And others who are, a small number who have actually gotten out because they can't handle it any longer. Right now, it is not legal for an FSB officer to leave the Russian Federation. The past few years, there have been restrictions placed on the international travel of FSB officers and retired, even former retired or resigned FSB officers. And today, it's actually not legal to resign from the FSB during a wartime situation. So if you want to leave it, you have to defect. You have to actually clandestinely leave the country. The only other option is to go along with it. If you agree with it, that's fine. You're happy with that. If you disagree with it, you just grumble and you do it because you don't really have many options. So several defectors in the past few years have said that there are streams of opposition within the FSB, but there's not a lot of avenue for them to express that.
This might be an impossible question to answer, but how do Russians view the FSB today? I mean, my colleagues in Medusa aren't big fans, but ordinary Russians or like Putin supporters, do they see them as, you know, just cops and nobody likes cops, or do they admire them?
It's a bit like going back to the Soviet era. I mentioned the party was seen as this corrupt organization. Everyone knew that the party boss was getting rich on his position. But, you know, we have the food that we need. We have jobs. So, you know, whatever. I'll do my job and let them do what they do. There's some of that in Russia today. The FSB is kind of taking that role today. a lot of people recognize the corruption within the FSB. There's actually been a lot of media inside Russia about it. There's been a lot of discussion. It's not been hidden. So Russians read about, at least some Russians, read about the corruption. Now, some of those stories have not been widely disseminated, but there is some discussion of it openly. Russians know that the system is corrupt. But if they can just do their job, if they can make a living and feed their family, then you know, whatever. If the war is not hurting me personally, then you know, I'll just live my life.
How much actual legitimate national security work does the FSB really do right now compared to political repression, which is the main other thing I think of it doing? What do you think the ratio is?
That's a hard one. Because it has such a significant law enforcement mission, and a lot of that law enforcement mission is, in fact, national security related, I think it's probably over 50% anyway. But as we saw on the 22nd of March, the terrorist attack in Moscow, there are some elements of what the FSB really was built to do to counter terrorism that have not been the primary focus, that using terrorist-related laws to pursue oppositionists has become a higher priority than using those same laws to counter actually terrorists. One mission that probably remains, they run a national security mission that remains probably pretty high on the FSB's list is counterintelligence. Counterterrorism may have been set aside because there's a whole different story with counterterrorism. Counterintelligence is still a priority, and that's the FSB's first service. That is still very much active. And we see that in arrests of supposed espionage subjects. We see that in the pursuit of and the harassment of diplomats, foreign diplomats within Moscow. Those are counterintelligence measures. And that is a first service that is very heavily active. The second service is where a lot of those oppositionist activities occur. And that's probably the strongest service in the FSB today, the second service that contains the remnants of what was once the KGB's fifth directorate, the ideological counterintelligence directorate, which was nominally shut down in 1991 at the end of the Soviet era, but then gradually reintroduced in the late 1990s and now is probably in full force. So those national security missions haven't gone away, particularly counterintelligence, but internal opposition is a very high priority. Another national security mission is maintaining security within the occupied territories of Ukraine. That's an FSB responsibility too. And as far as Russia is concerned, that is a national security mission. That's a mix of counterespionage, counter-opposition, and it's kind of both of those. And that's a pretty high priority too. So I don't know if I can put a percentage on it, but those are both seem to be at the top of the list.
What are the FSB's main tools for suppressing dissent among Russian citizens? I guess what it sees as counterterrorism based on how it's charging people, or, you know, counter-extremism or separatism.
Right. The FSB has the responsibility for a spectrum of statutes. And all of those statutes can be used for countering opposition. You can call it extremism, and someone who is speaking against the war can be called an extremist. And that's obviously a common allegation. But a number of people who have opposed the Putin regime have also been arrested on economic charges, such as fraud or illegal imports or illegal connections to foreign economic institutions. So the economic crimes are also an important tool that the FSB has. Another important tool is just the FSB's ability to monitor communications within Russia. That's an intelligence collection responsibility, and it has both a foreign and a domestic element to it. But because the FSB has the kind of back doors into most, I would say probably all, of the communications channels within Russia, It can monitor discussions as they are happening rather than waiting for a threat to germinate and blossom. The FSB uses something that was coined during the Soviet era called prophylactic discussions, which means you observe someone doing something of concern, posting something on the internet that is opposition related, having a telephone conversation with a friend, a human agent overhearing someone say something, that kind of domestic intelligence responsibility that picks up someone's oppositionist sentiment, and the FSB can go knock on their door and say, we think you're headed down the wrong path. We think you should turn around now before you really get into trouble. And those prophylactic discussions can actually be quite effective. They can scare people. They can let people know that we hear you, we know what you're doing. And that is an effective way of cutting off activity before it actually becomes dangerous. So the FSB does try to preempt that opposition activity even before it turns into large demonstrations or to someone like Alexei Navalny coming along, try to prevent the next Alexei Navalny from occurring through those prophylactic discussions, which it learns about through its intelligence collection capabilities within the country.
So just to be clear, does this intelligence collecting include everything I'm picturing, like wiretapping and hacking people's computers? Or is it more often like public comments people leave on the internet and people reporting their classmates and that kind of thing?
It's all of these, all of those. Hacking into computers may not be as necessary because the FSB actually can monitor the communications lines. So certainly there will be incidents of hacking into someone's computer, but if you can read the traffic without having to break into the computer, then that's even easier. So hacking computers might happen, but probably more often it's just listening to internet traffic, doing keyword searches on traffic streams, and then identifying that activity early.
So I know it's the SVR, Russia's Foreign Intelligence Service, that, and not the FSB, that's generally conducting foreign intelligence operations abroad. But what overlap is there between the SVR's activities and the FSB's, and how extensive are the FSB's operations abroad?
Russia actually has two foreign intelligence services. One is the GU, or formerly called the GRU, so that's the military intelligence, and that's a foreign intelligence collection organization. And the SVR, or the Foreign Intelligence Service, is the non-military side. So both of those are the primary foreign collectors. But when you hear about intelligence activities occurring in the post-Soviet space, for example, when the Ukrainian SBU arrests a human source within Ukraine, a human source that is collecting tactical military intelligence about the landing points of missiles and correcting missile targeting and that sort of thing. Those are usually run by the FSB, not the SVR or the GRU. And the reason for that is because the FSB is the primary intelligence collection organization for the post-Soviet space. That's an indicator of how the Russian government views the post-Soviet space. And it's not just Ukraine, it's other countries as well, such as the Baltic states. Many of the espionage cases that have been arrested, as espionage subjects that have been arrested in the Baltic states, have also been run by the FSB. That is an indicator that the FSB continues to see the post-Soviet space as Russian domestic territory. The FSB is an internal security service primarily, but that post-Soviet space outside the Russian Federation continues to be in the doctrine of the FSB internal security. The SVR, you'll see much less often working in the post-Soviet space. So not a lot of overlap there. What we see the SVR doing today is being heavily involved in diplomatic intelligence and what are the perceptions of Russia abroad. When we hear about, for example, the expansion of the BRICS bloc in 2023. Six new countries joined the BRICS bloc. Undoubtedly, the SVR collected a significant amount of intelligence about those countries' perceptions, about those countries' priorities that supported the negotiations that led to that expansion of BRICS. That's just one example, but that ability of Russia to portray itself in the world is supported by SVR collection, probably. SVR is also involved in economic collection, which means understanding foreign states' stances on sanctions toward Russia and the economic harm that Russia is enduring based upon the international sanctions. That's probably an SVR matter to pursue. So they both have some what we would consider foreign intelligence responsibilities, but the FSB's is primarily focused within the post-Soviet space.
While we're on the topic of Russia's foreign intelligence agencies, maybe it's too sensational, but I have to ask, have you read the Insider's investigation into Havana Syndrome?
I have. And it surprises me a little, but I can't question their sources. I don't have any reason to question their sources. But the reason it surprises me, or there are a couple of reasons it surprises me. There were these gentlemen agreements during the Soviet era that Western intelligence services and KGB or GRU would operate against each other aggressively up to the point, but not beyond the point of physically harming each other. And the reason for that gentleman's agreement was almost like a mutually assured destruction sort of argument. If you hurt us, I mean, if we hurt you, you then have the freedom to hurt us. And it was a kind of self-preservation that I don't want my officers being beat up in your country, so I'm not going to beat your officers in my country. That doesn't mean they don't harass each other. That doesn't mean they don't, you know, leave evidence of entering someone's apartment in Moscow and making obviously clear that they were there and making harassing phone calls to them. That's within the pale. But physically harming someone was always outside it. That's why it surprises me if it has gone beyond that kind of gentleman's agreement. Now, I've heard some people say, well, you can't make a gentleman's agreement with a corrupt organization like the FSB or with the Russian intelligence services today. And to a certain extent, maybe they're just not as principles-based as they once were. But they still have self-preservation as an interest. And so if it is conclusively determined that, as the Insider article said, the GRU was behind this, and that opens up avenues for foreign intelligence services to hurt GRU officers. And that's not, I wouldn't think the GRU would want that. So it surprises me, but I can't refute what they've said.
Do you have any professional knowledge that makes you think it's more or less likely that Russia could have developed this kind of technology, or that they're spending time at least trying to develop these things?
Developing the technology is something that has been proven that Russia has, yes. I think there's no question that the technology exists. The Soviet Union was working on similar technology before the dissolution of the Soviet Union. So the capability is there, the access, the opportunity is there. If you're using the threat equation, capability times opportunity times intent, the capability and the opportunity are both there. The question is the intent. And that still is something that we don't have the direct evidence of. So that's why it remains circumstantial.
Another thing that's happened since your book came out is the Crocus City Hall terrorist attack. So I want to ask you about that. Based on everything you know about the history of the FSB's cooperations with U.S. intelligence agencies, have you been at all surprised by the way this has unfolded, with the U.S. saying it warned Moscow about the attack and maybe even named the venue specifically, and then Russia blaming the U.S. for not being specific enough and insinuating the U.S. could have played a role in the attack? It sounds pretty typical, actually, based on your book. So how have you been observing this?
There have been examples in the past of sharing of counterterrorism information across in both directions. That was legitimate counterterrorism information that actually led, in several cases, to FSB arrest actions inside Russia. 2017, the U.S. shared intelligence with the FSB in relation to a terrorist attack at a cathedral in St. Petersburg. 2019, there was another example of sharing counterterrorism information about another attack. I think it was at a shopping mall in St. Petersburg during or around the New Year's Eve timeframe. After that 2019 example, Putin actually publicly thanked the United States for sharing that information. The situation is completely different today because of the war in Ukraine. The war in Ukraine prohibits politically Russia from accepting as valid anything that the United States says. The United States may give them the best information in the world, but Russia cannot allow itself to acknowledge that as positive because Putin personally has staked his political future on the defeat of Ukraine and the NATO forces that Putin says are behind it. So there's nothing that NATO or a US or a NATO country can do today that can be in any way politically positive in the in that environment. And so in addition to that, Putin has staked his political history, his early political history, on the defeat of terrorism. He became popular because he was tough on terrorism. He swept terrorists out of Chechnya. By 2009, he claimed that the war was over, that terrorists have been defeated. If he allows himself to acknowledge that a major terrorist attack occurred in Moscow after having been warned, that makes him look bad personally. And by tying his personal political fate to terrorism early and Ukraine now, that just prevents him from accepting anything the United States might say.
So Wall Street Journal reporter and U.S. citizen Evan Gershkovich was detained by the FSB over a year ago now, and he's been in Lefortovo prison ever since, which is associated with the FSB. Based on what you know about the FSB, how do you imagine this decision to arrest a foreign journalist unfolds? Do you think they have a list and they decide they want to take a journalist for some reason from a specific country and then they choose one? Or do they sort of wait for the opportunity and respond to what's going on?
There's probably some reaction to opportunities that exist. There's a couple of things that would prompt that arrest. An event that happened outside Russia where a Russian action was somehow thwarted, and this could be retaliation for something. It also could be that right now oppositionists are illegal, and a foreign journalist that is in talking to oppositionists is seen as an illegal actor, is seen as a spy. So I don't know exactly what Gershkovich was doing, but I wouldn't be surprised if he was talking to oppositionists, and that becomes a cause for arrest, just as it would for the Russians who were involved in that opposition activity. But it also gives Russia a chance to emphasize the claim that Western intelligence services are everywhere and they're out to get us, that they have spies all over the place. Their journalists are all spies. Their NGOs are all spies. Their diplomats are all spies. Spies are everywhere. And this gives the FSB the opportunity to press that point home with the Russian people. So to a certain extent, the audience for that was multiple. It was the US government saying, don't mess with us. But it was also the Russian people saying, look at all the spies and be careful. So it accomplished multiple objectives at the same time.
Finally, I'd like to ask you to look into the future a little bit, especially post-Putin. How likely is the FSB to stay in power and have another one of its people take control? And what are the different possible scenarios you think are likely, especially given the fact that in your book, you talk about the lower level of competence in the FSB compared to the KGB. What impact does that have?
Russia has a demographic problem where the younger people are not as well educated. Many of those with higher education have left the country. That's not to say there's no one in Russia with higher education. Certainly there are very well-educated Russians, but it's not to portray Russians as all, you know, country bumpkins or anything. But a lot of the higher educated people have actually left the country. And that then leaves a less promising future, not just for the FSB, but for a lot of organizations within Russia. After Putin, there are a couple different scenarios. One is that he could be replaced by an FSB person. There are some rising FSB seniors, some general level officers who are on the edges of the inner circle that could potentially rise up or be picked out of obscurity, similar to how Putin was picked out of obscurity in 1999 to become the prime minister, or 1998 to become the FSB director. That's a likely scenario. That right now there probably is not an official successor who's been named. Autocrats usually don't name successors because that puts them in a lame duck situation, and they don't want their power to be diluted by a potential successor. So likely there is no successor named, but there are some up and coming FSB officers, seniors, who are of a similar mind to Putin and who could pick up the reins from Putin. Much of Putin's inner circle are of the same age as he is, in their upper 60s, lower 70s. So they're not going to be around that much longer than Putin. I mean, they're not in bad health or anything. I mean, they have the best doctors that Russia can offer, but they are getting older and they won't live forever. So it's going to have to be someone younger than them who is chosen as a successor, probably. An alternative to that, and less likely, is that someone from outside the security structure is chosen. Someone like a Medvedev, who has, in the past 2 years, been the designated clown for the Russian government. He's not a security service careerist. Or the prime minister, Mishustin, he's not a career security service person. But the problem with those choices is they would have to take control of the security service, and they may not have the political power to do that. So it's a higher chance that it's someone from one of the security services, likely a person who is younger. Now, I think I mentioned in the book, but if Putin were to just suddenly die, like Stalin did in March 1953, the likely initial reaction would be that the members of Putin's inner circle would all go after each other because they don't like each other. And the only reason they're cooperating is because Putin is keeping them together. Similar to the elites in Stalin's inner circle in the 1950s. But when Stalin disappeared, they all stabbed each other in the back. Beria got arrested within just a few weeks, and eventually others were shifted off to unknown jobs in other places. And one Khrushchev finally kind of bubbled to the top. Something like that would likely occur because those elites have their own power centers, and those power centers don't cooperate with each other very well. And they would go after each other initially until one of them finally came out of the dust on top.
Thanks for tuning in, folks. This has been The Naked Pravda, a podcast from Medusa in English. Remember that undesirable status back in Russia means our entire news outlet now relies on readers and listeners around the world to support our work. Please visit our website for information about how to become a contributor with one-time or recurring pledges. Thanks again. Until next week.